The Government Operations Subcommittee will now come to order. Lexi, please call the roll.
Chair Fisher.
Here.
Representatives Barrero.
Here.
Ranking Member Chambliss. Fabricio.
Here.
Fetterhoff.
Here.
Hinson.
Here.
Jenny.
Here.
Killebrew. Killebrew. McClure.
Here.
McCurdy.
Here.
Rizzo. Rizzo. Vice Chair Rodriguez. Roth.
Here.
Sabatini. Shove.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Smith C.
Here.
Zika.
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you, Lexi. Members, please make sure to silence all cell phones and communication devices, including laptops. Make sure those are placed on silent or turned off. Good afternoon. I want to welcome everyone to the Government Operations Subcommittee. For today's meeting, we have Chief Inspector General. Who will conduct a presentation concerning a few matters of interest to this committee. The Chief Inspector General will explain her role and the role of the agency's inspector generals, her office's final report regarding statutory compensation limit compliance, and the implementation of two bills we passed last year, House Bill 1079 regarding agency contracting, and HB 1297 regarding cybersecurity. After the presentation, we'll recognize members for questions. With that, I want to welcome the Chief Inspector General, Melinda Miguel. Ms. Miguel, you are recognized when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. It's my privilege to be here today. We've got several topics to discuss with you at the request of the chair. One is, as the chair said, the overview of the IGs, and that's where I'm going to start. So Section 20.055 we fondly refer to as the Florida Inspector General Act. This outlines the duties and responsibilities of the agency inspectors general. Our mission is about fraud, waste, abuse, and economy and efficiency in government. And we conduct audits, investigations, including Whistleblower Act investigations, as well as other reviews and inquiries. We are housed in each state agency, and the governor's agency inspectors general report to the chief IG, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. Florida is unique in its structure, but not unlike the federal IG model, with some exceptions. For instance, Florida inspectors general have administrative investigative jurisdiction over their agencies, but the feds, for instance, have criminal investigative jurisdiction. Florida model actually relies on our Florida Department of Law Enforcement to pursue criminal investigations. Some additional duties of the inspectors general based upon this statute is that we conduct periodic risk assessments. We also prepare annual work plans, including with the passage of the bill that I'll touch on later, a specific cybersecurity audit plan. We publish our annual reports by September 30th of each year, and we are subject to audit peer reviews every 3 years by the Legislative Auditor General. We also adopted an investigative accreditation program through the Commission for Law Enforcement Accreditation. We are the only state in the nation that has this accreditation program, and I'm very proud of that. This slide is, I think, important to note that I will talk a little bit further about the cybersecurity audit specifics once we get a little bit into the presentation. So the Inspector General Act of 1994, these are some additional duties. We handle complaints received in the agencies. I already mentioned the Whistleblower Act investigations. We also liaison with outside agencies, especially during the pandemic with some of the pandemic oversight at the federal government level. Also, a key aspect is that we have access to any and all records or other information necessary and may request assistance from a state agency or from a government entity to assist us in our duties. The Chief Inspector General, outlines the duties and responsibilities of my office. I'm appointed by the governor. I coordinate complaint handling activities with the agencies. I also man the whistleblower hotline. I also serve as the Inspector General for the Executive Office of the Governor, which means I do audits and investigations as well. So some additional responsibilities of the Chief Inspector General that are unique and passed were as a result of a change in 2015 was that the Chief Inspector General appoints, evaluates, and removes the Governor's Agency Inspectors General. We also now have authority to issue subpoenas, and we may investigate upon request of the Governor certain issues regardless of administrative finality. On the rare instance that we have a complaint against an agency inspector general, if it's a governor's agency, then the chief IG will look into those as well. One of the fundamentals about our statute is that we are required to have our professional standards adopted. So we adopt the Red Book standards as published by the Institute of Internal Auditors. We also have adopted in law as of 2008 the Green Book as published by the National Association of Inspectors General, of which I'm the past national president. Oftentimes you may hear about this concept of organizational independence related to the role of an inspector general or an internal auditor. This is some of the organizational independence elements as required by our standards. I just wanted you to have that for context when we talk a little bit later about the Cybersecurity Council. But one of the fundamentals about this independence is so that our work will have greater credibility and can be relied upon as an objective third-party evaluation of the operations of an agency. In essence, we don't have a dog in that fight. It's not our program. We don't own it. So we have that extra layer of independence. To shift gears a little bit for our second topic, and many of you may have heard a presentation back last spring related to Executive Order 2044. This particular project was issued based upon Governor DeSantis issuing the Executive Order 2044 on February 20 of 2020. This was as a result of some of the headlines that you may have heard about with the Miami Herald coverage, with the CEO of the Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence. There were headlines that drew light to the $7.5 million plus in paid time off or other benefits to the CEO and a few other high-ranking executives of the coalition. The funds in question for this were in whole or in part the Florida Department of Children and Families funds. In the executive order, there was actually four requirements, four sections. The first section, this is an overview of what was required to specifically identify those entities that are sole source or a public-private agreement as outlined in statute, and to identify which agencies are allocating funds to those entities that annually receive 50% or more of their budget from state or federal funds. Section 2 requirements also were certain requirements that were outlined to require that the entities obtain the IRS Form 990s and other documentation regarding the listed contractors' executive leadership teams for the past year. And if the compensation exceeded the limits set forth in federal or state law, the agency shall refer that matter to the Chief Inspector General for appropriate action. Section 3 requirements were to be submitted within 45 days of submission from the first list from Section 1. And each executive agency must verify compliance of those contractors doing business with the state to verify that they were, in fact, following up and complying with the Florida Single Audit Act. If, in fact, there were any findings from those, a corrective action plan had to be submitted to the state and a timeline to identify when those findings would, in fact, be resolved. The next requirement is just a screenshot, if you will, of that IRS 990 form to kind of give you an idea of the level of detail that we were requiring. One of the things that we specifically asked for relative to the entity's executive leadership teams was that total compensation shall include salary, bonuses, cashed-in leave, cash equivalents, severance pay, retirement benefits, deferred compensation, real property gifts, and any other payout. So that was the background for the information that we actually requested. This is the timeline. We first asked for those in April of 2020. Due to the pandemic and the amount of activities that were going on at the time, we did grant two extensions for Section 1. We ended up getting information as late as January of 2020. just due to the fact that the agencies were overwhelmed with activities going on with the pandemic. So we understood that this was not the first priority during that time. So our data collection, our agency inspectors general gathered together and came up with an executive order template that would make it easier for the agencies to comply. Also, we were able to provide guidance on the information that we wanted back from the agencies to provide a little bit of a consistency for our evaluation. So the set of instructions were included as a template guidance for the agencies to follow. Just to sort of highlight some of those requirements, there was an Excel spreadsheet that we used to coalesce and aggregate all of this information. And these are some of the entries that we expected from the agency so that we could sort, evaluate, and analyze the information that was submitted. So the sole source information, just to kind of give you a background, there were some compensation limits. These are just a reminder of what those sections required. And just to jump ahead just a little bit on the data collected, you will see, and I'll give you a little bit more detail in the next slides, but there were 28 agencies that met the criteria set forth in sections 1 through 3 of the executive order. And then the remaining 14 agencies did not meet the criteria in that first 1 through 3 sections. And so they were not required to provide any additional information. So this is an example of the 28 applicable agencies that were responding to our request for information. So as you can see, it's a pretty exhaustive list, and they were submitting that information to us. So these, again, are the recap of the requirements, and the results are now on this slide and shows that approximately 839 unique entities were applicable to Section 1. For Section 1A, there were approximately 166 unique entities that were named in statute that were in fact sole source. And then there were approximately 561 unique entities that annually received their budget of 50% or more of their budget from the state or a combination of state and federal. Here is the list meeting Section 1A, the sole source. And you can kind of see the array of those entities per agency. And when I say 166 unique agencies, that was to deduplicate some of the information that was in the responses so that we could get pure numbers for you. So you can see at the top of the list, the Department of Education has the largest number of sole source required entities in statute. There was an array of differing types of providers that were in this list. Some of those providers were community-based care entities, health network, homelessness, early learning coalitions, Big Brother, Big Sister, Girl Scouts, Lighthouse of the Blind, Able Trust, Bethune-Cookman, Dan Marino Foundation, and Volunteer USA. This is the list that met the criteria in Section 1B of the executive order that shows the number of entities that receive greater than 50% of their annual budget from the state. And so you can see that there were 387, but the deduplicated count is 379 unique entities. And this slide shows that there were 580 or 561 unique entities that annually receive 50% or more of their budget from the state or a combination of state and federal funds. So just to recap the next section that I'm going to cover, this is if the compensation totals exceed the limits set forth in state or federal law. So remember back to the Excel spreadsheet that I sort of explained, the agencies were asked to input this information and under these categories. And so this would have been a simple yes or no answer as to whether or not this compensation amount did in fact exceed, or if they did in fact have a state limit imposed on their compensation. So we compiled a list of 179 entities in which the comp limits were applicable to the executive leadership teams of those entities contracting with the state. 167 of those did not have anything in excess of the state limits. They did not exceed the statutory caps, but there were 12 entities that had compensation limits that potentially exceeded those statutory caps. I'll give you a little bit of detail. As you can see here, of those 12 entities with potentially excess compensations, we had those fall under 9 entities under the DCF, and three entities under the Department of Education. The Department of Education, in further follow-up activities, they noted in its response that the compensations were reimbursed to the then Office of Early Learning as disallowed costs. So that left nine entities for us to evaluate in further detail. Let me just, before I go on, for the DCF CBCs, there were two individuals that were compensated at $291,000 and $248,000 respectively. It should be noted that the individual compensation at the $248,000 was paid based upon a contractually agreed upon bonus in 2017, and that was the year of the law change, and the contract for that was actually signed prior to the law change. Section 3, just to recap, that's remember the Single Audit Act, and if they had any findings and were those findings adequately addressed with a corrective action plan. In our further follow-up activities, we found out that there were 39 entities that had one or more finding. They did have corrective action plans in place. And as a follow-up, we did determine that 32 of those 39 had resolved all prior year findings. Two audits had not yet been completed by the time we issued the report, so those are still outstanding, and we will determine if corrective actions have resolved those prior year findings. Just to recap on Section 4, this was about the 990, the annual requirements. So as an ongoing future obligation on the state agencies, this executive order called for each executive agency to henceforth require from entities that meet the criteria in Section 1 of the executive order an annual report. And this annual report should include the most recent IRS Form 990 detailing the total compensation for the entity's leadership teams. So they were also to then require those entities to agree through an appropriate contract or grant agreement amendment to inform the agency of any changes in total compensation between those annual reports, and all compensation reports must indicate what percentage of compensation comes directly from state or federal allocations to the contracted entity. As I mentioned, this is an ongoing requirement into the future, and we will be determining compliance with this section going forward. So a quick wrap-up as I summarize the steps taken as we concluded this project. We held an entrance conference with each of the entities and that we had surveyed and had examined supporting documentation that they had provided so that we understood the facts of their situation. We also conducted other review as appropriate, and we hosted an exit conference with those entities. We prepared a preliminary report, of which we then provided in a public setting much like this in the summer of spring of last year. And then we allowed the entities their opportunity to respond to the final report. And then their response actually becomes an attachment to our final report. So it travels together into perpetuity, giving them that opportunity to express their issues or concerns or their agreement or whatever their comments would be, so that their responses become part of our final. I would like to acknowledge the help and support of the DOTIG and the DCFIG, and I want to recognize that the providers, every one of them, did cooperate with us during this process. So on to our next project. With the passage of House Bill 1079, and I believe this committee has already received a briefing from Roz Ingram, our Chief Procurement Officer, about this particular bill, but there is a provision there in Section 2 that affects the Inspector General community that I'm here to kind of cover briefly for you today. The language specifically states that beginning of October 1st of 2021 and every 3 years thereafter, each agency inspector general shall complete a risk-based compliance audit of all contracts executed by the agency in the previous 3 years. Based upon certain meetings with the IGs, we determined that this was going to apply to those contracts under Chapter 287. And in looking at the audit cycle and annually publishing our audit plans, we believed it was important to go ahead and include these requirements in the audit plan for the current fiscal year, because the law took effect July 1 of 2021. So our work will be reflective of the language that House Bill 1079 specifies. So in trying to scope out the work and how we would be able to produce the results, and we evaluated that all of the contracts are supposed to be issued and updated in a system that's maintained by the Department of Financial Services called FACS. So Section 215-985, called the Transparency Florida Act, requires that each state entity post certain information about related contracts into online system. I'm going to show you a brief snapshot of what that looks like. This system is accessible to the public, and it is made available by the Department of Financial Services. In the event that you want greater detail about this system, you can find that at www.facs.fldfs.com. So we went through, sorted everything that was for the applicable time period, and we evaluated the impact, the numbers that would fall out by each agency. And there was a total of 133,000 contracts that were in this period. But we, through our evaluation, we were able to determine that the ones that would require the compliance audit evaluation every 3 years at this time, through this time period, would be about 9,747 contracts for the Department of Transportation, a total of 28,000. And you can kind of see the array of how these numbers of contracts span across the various different agencies. I selected the ones that were probably the larger numbers, and then you see all other agencies there is about 5,000. This does not include contracts outside of the date range that we're asked to look at. And we did have a little trouble with FACS, and I want to go through exactly the kinds of things that we encountered with the data quality when we were looking. This is a screenshot, though, of the FACS system. You can see how it sorts, and this screenshot here kind of shows you on a key set of types of contracts. You can kind of see these are the ones for the Department of Citrus. You can see the vendor. You can see certain information. So it's a sample of search results that we found in FACS. So based upon our research in trying to tee up this and accomplish this objective, we had discussions with the agency inspectors general. We worked across the community to factor in everyone's perspective. We did have a couple of ongoing priorities that we thought were important to address. So multiple contracts improperly going to the same vendors or patterns of vendor preference was something that was in the statutory language for us to try to be sure that we could evaluate that so that we could come back to the legislature and offer a report on this. We had a little bit of concern because if we have each agency inspector general evaluating their own sets of contracts in their agencies, we were going to need to figure out a way to provide an enterprise-wide review so that we could get across agencies if there were these patterns and trends that you were asking us in House Bill 1079 to detect. We also raised the concern internally in our discussions about the possibility that the agencies may be overusing certain exempt procurements and not necessarily putting them all in FACS. So we convened a work group. We issued guidance for the audit. We did provide a standardized template for reporting. And our audit field work is underway. We are providing technical assistance to all of the agencies and hosting biweekly calls so that our work product will be relatively consistent for you guys to decipher, analyze, and receive, and hopefully get some valuable information. Some of the issues that we identified so far is that the preliminary review of FACS had some data quality issues. We also noted that the Auditor General had revealed that at least one agency was not posting all of their contracts into FACS in 2019. So the details are not yet fully known across the agencies, but the data will be available once our final reviews are complete. But just to give you a sample, you can see this was a sort in FACS. This is the kind of data quality issues we detected. You can see for the vendor name here, there is no agency. So the agency field was left blank. So we need to go back and determine which agency does this contract belong to and have the agency correct that information so that we can do a quality, thorough review of all contracts. Here's another sample. If you see this one, you can tell that it was a, you can see the department names on the left and there in the middle. You'll note that St. Lucie was spelled several different ways. Five, I think, in this particular case. So St. Lucie County Board of County Commissioners, St. Lucie County Board of County, St. Lucie County, et cetera. So we had these sorts of things that we had to kind of sort through and smooth before we can finalize any review. So we're working with our agencies to have our agencies be sure that they update the contracts entered into the system accurately. Here's a snagget from our Auditor General's report that shows that at least one agency back at that time was not posting information and facts. So that's just for your context so that when you get our final work product, you'll know that we've resolved all those issues and give you the results of our review. But that's kind of some of the things that we've experienced to date. Year one planned activities. The inspectors general are completing our data quality reviews of their agency's facts data, including ensuring that all contracts are entered into the system. And inspectors general are then going to conduct or are conducting a risk-based sampling of agency procurements. The audit reports are due by the end of March. The agencies are expected to address any data issues by the end of June. And then the Chief Inspector General, we are considering issuing a final roll-up report so that you get the data that you need to kind of get that enterprise-wide focus of what 1079 requires. So the next section, changing gears a little bit. This is, just to reiterate, the Chair wanted me to be sure that I strictly complied with all confidentiality requirements related to cybersecurity audits. And this is just a statement for context I want you to have so that you'll understand that all my comments are coming from this lens to be sure that we do everything we can to protect our state from release of any information that might put us in harm's way. The next sections, we will discuss the audit planning activities that were required. As you know, I'm going to give you a little background. You probably remember when CIO Grant came and spoke to your committee about House Bill 5301. This was the passage of date of that was 2019, where it established a Florida Cybersecurity Task Force. It recommended certain objectives for improvement, and we were to submit a report to the governor and the Senate and the Speaker by a certain deadline, and we had certain recommendations. One of those was a proposed $30 million appropriation as a starting place, with $1 million of that going to the Inspector General community. I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about the NIST requirements, the NIST framework, and about the $1 million related to the IG community. So House Bill 1297, if you jump forward to 2021, passed in 2021's legislative session regarding cybersecurity. And it too clarified, and you've had this presentation, so I won't read it to you verbatim, but one of the requirements, if you jump down to the almost the last bullet there, is it required the inspectors general to include a specific cybersecurity audit plan, and it gave us an effective date. So in implementing the House Bill 1297, each agency inspector general, as a routine requirement, prepared their annual audit plans effective July 1st. But also, to be sure that we held close to the spirit of House Bill 1297, we also went about doing the risk assessment and the audit planning to ensure that we met the spirit and the letter of House Bill 1297 to have a specific audit plan include and address cybersecurity. In going through this activity and exercise, all of the governor's agency inspectors general are involved. And if the cabinet agency IGs wish to participate in this enterprise-wide effort, they can opt in. They are certainly welcome, and we have many that have done so. So in our risk assessment planning and audit preparation, these are some of the high-level steps of what work has been done by the governor's agency inspectors general. We did go through and interview the Florida Digital Services IT Security Management. We did review the 2020 risk assessments. We also reviewed the agency strategic and operations plans submitted to DMS. We evaluated the task force recommendations. This is another slide kind of for context. As you know, Florida has adopted the NIST framework. It is also cited in current chapter 60GG, Florida Administrative Code. This is a framework that just provides a high-level analysis of the functions and the categories that fall under this cybersecurity framework that we operate in here in Florida. I want to drill down and draw your attention there to the DE identifier, the detect function. And you can kind of see there, it's a pinkish color where the one in the middle says security continuous monitoring. This slide is pulling that out of that framework and kind of gives you a little bit of a drill down. And the area that we chose to focus for this first audit across the enterprise is security continuous monitoring. So I want to drill down one more time. And if you see it now, it expands the level of detail to the subcategory level. So you can see what elements are under this particular NIST framework for security continuous monitoring. So this NIST framework talks about this subcategory where we monitor the network to detect potential cybersecurity events. You can see detect malicious code, et cetera. Those are the steps that we will be evaluating every single agency to determine to what extent do they comply with the NIST framework under these subcategories. So you can see that we will be evaluating each agency in further detail. This is the scope of the audit and the objectives. It just basically lifts the information I just showed you in the framework and puts it in our language for our audit report. So you can actually see those monitoring activities. We want to verify that agencies are performing vulnerability scans. We want to monitor for unauthorized access. We want to monitor, see what the agencies are doing to monitor for malicious code. So as it relates to our cybersecurity audit preparations, the Chief Inspector General's office distributed audit guidance by module. When I say by module, go back to that NIST framework for our subcategories. We also conducted a 3-day in-depth training using in-house expertise on each of those 8 modules. We created a report template for the agencies to use, so it'll make it a little bit easier for you guys to get information from us, so it'll all be kind of portrayed in a consistent fashion. So audit work is underway. We expect to be completed by spring of 2022. We are excited about working with the agencies to obtain this baseline on where they stand. One of the things that we found and was a challenge for us is we, like the rest of the world, are experiencing some skills and talent gaps related to cybersecurity. We only had 8 certified information systems auditors among the Inspector General community. So we took those 8 CISAs and actually had them put on this training. So over a 3-day period, we had 60 auditors go through in depth with these trained certified information systems auditors to go and drill down into each module so that we could have a level of assurance that we were using trained, current skills with our trained certified information systems auditors. At the end of the project, we will be issuing our results. As I mentioned again, just to remind you that those results will be confidential and exempt, except for those on an allowed distribution. The Chief Inspector General will issue a roll-up report of the Agency Inspectors General. The Agency Inspectors General are going to issue each individual audits per agency so that we can have some valuable information to provide the Chief Information Officer and the Executive Office of the Governor on our state of affairs in terms of cyber in this NIST framework on the subcategory of continuous security monitoring. Very briefly, and as I begin to wrap up, as you remember from CIO Grant's presentation, he touched on the upcoming Cybersecurity Council. I won't belabor the details and points that he's already gone over with you, but I do want to highlight a little bit for you the unique role of the Chief Inspector General. I am a member of this council. I'm super excited to participate. I'm grateful that the legislature included us on that panel for context. The span of duties as it relates to the Chief Inspector General must also follow professional standards. So I assure you that our professional standards will be followed. But that really provides that I will be able to provide audit, investigative, and consulting services that are allowed by our professional standards. I'm an audit and investigative practitioner, so I can't assume operational duties of the CIO, but I can help the council as it relates to consulting with them on risk, on subject matter information relative to audit, on investigation, and I'm super excited to do so. As we finalize, I'm very grateful for the appropriation that has been provided to the agency inspectors general. Based upon the talent gaps that we were finding and the challenges that we are having with our workforce to maintain qualified cybersecurity skills on our teams, we received $1 million from the $30 million cybersecurity appropriation, and this will serve to help the Inspector General community with certain deliverables. We created and prepared an operational work plan with a monthly spend plan and submitted it for evaluation. I'm proud to say that yesterday it was approved and the money was posted in FLAIR. And our deliverables will include certain outcomes that we expect. We will have a information systems audit professional in each agency. We will also ensure that each inspector general receive appropriate cybersecurity training in the governance field. We also want to make sure that our investigators receive up-to-the-minute, state-of-the-art investigative training from a cybersecurity perspective. And so we are super grateful for that project and that appropriation. And I believe that now concludes my remarks for today. And thank you so very much for your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chief Inspector. I appreciate your thorough presentation. Members, do we have any questions? Representative Henson, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I'm always impressed with your knowledge. In your cybersecurity audit, did you have any significant findings? And then how secure are you that the crash that occurred over the weekend was not a security issue?
You're recognized.
Thank you. I appreciate the question, a very informed in question. So a couple of things. Our audit is underway. We have not concluded our audit. Our audit findings will be published in draft in spring of 2022. Those audit findings will then go to agency management for their comment, and then we will have a final report for you, hopefully in spring. So I don't have the final results for the audit as you reference, but I'm excited to have final results that we will be able to share. As it relates to my security, I think is how secure am I? I think is how you worded it, if that's right. On the activities of this weekend, I believe that you're referring to certain hardware concerns that occurred and caused certain outages and unavailability of certain systems across our state. I talked with Jamie Grant yesterday. He shared with me that there is no evidence of anything beyond a hardware failure, but I believe that I would need to direct you to him for right now for everything that is currently under evaluation for further follow-up. I know things are changing rapidly. Information is coming to him on a fast-paced schedule. So I will defer to CIO Grant at this time.
You recognize for follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The systems you put in place, the templates, the different things, had you already conducted an audit using your current system, would you be able to distinguish between whether or not this was a hardware failure versus a cybersecurity issue?
I think that's more of an operational question for CIO Grant, but you're recognized to answer if you think you can provide any details.
I believe that our audit is scoped in such a way for us to look at whether or not the agencies are continuously monitoring their networks to ensure security, to ensure endpoint access is only properly authorized, to ensure that any malicious code from any bad actors that might enter a network, for instance, might be detected in what the agencies are doing. I don't know enough yet about the issues from the weekend to give you assurances about what the audit would or wouldn't detect. So I think I would have to hedge a little bit, not knowing the full facts of the circumstances right now. Thank you for your understanding.
Representative Schoaf, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the executive compensation portion that you discussed, how would you handle a hypothetical situation where, let's say, an executive that oversees multiple nonprofits or multiple nonprofits underneath their silo, all dependent on public dollars, and let's say they collect $120,000 salary from each of the entities for a total of $1 million. How is that skirting it, or is that how do you handle that?
You're recognized.
I think that there is a House bill that passed in 2017 relative to community-based care organizations that said that the CEOs of a CBC could only receive up to 150% of what the agency secretary, the Department of Children and Families secretary, was making. So if that is the will of the legislature and a bill has been imposed to establish certain caps, then I think that needs to be monitored rigorously for compliance with what the laws are. If you're talking about an area where there's no caps established and it's state funds, my answer is one thing. If you talk about an area where it's state and federal funds, federal laws have certain limits to compensation based upon the caps that they allow in their cost allocation plans. Their indirect costs cannot exceed a certain threshold. State law doesn't have all of those specifics, but generally speaking, oftentimes these organizations are recipients of state and federal dollars. So if you have a state law, obviously the state law prevails. If the federal law applies, of course the federal law applies. If you have no statutory caps or minimums, then I would hope that they would use a reasonable person test. But if the legislature hasn't, or the department hasn't, established certain caps for their contractors doing business, then I think that that's a gray area for room for interpretation and or seeking guidance from their granting organizations for clarity would be something that I would recommend.
Any follow-up? Members, do we have any other questions? Representative McCurdy, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Back to the early in the presentation, you mentioned vendor preferences for state agencies. I just wanted to ask if an agency has identified a particular vendor as preferred for their specific services, is there any type of, are they required to solicit from multiple vendors?
You're recognized.
Thank you. I am not the procurement expert. I wish I was. Roz Ingram, who appeared before this committee, does a great job at knowing exactly which types of procurements are necessary depending upon the buckets of funds. So depending upon the amount, the threshold that's applied in statute, I think determines whether they have to be competitively bid. I'm not sure that that answers your question. And then did you have a second part to that question that I missed?
Or? No, I just briefly just read it. It was at the beginning. I'm sorry.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you. Sorry, no. I just wanted to go back because at the beginning of the presentation, you mentioned, I think, trying to limit such repetitive vendors from being used by agencies. But I just wanted to raise that point because I feel if a vendor is working for a specific agency, we don't want to force them to go out and bid, you know, to waste resources and staff. So thank you.
You're recognized.
I don't believe that there's anything that I read in the statute or in the bill that passed to suggest that we steer clear of repeating business with a quality performing vendor. I think if a vendor is doing their job and they're delivering the what's expected by the contract, I don't think that there's anything that to say that repeat vendors is a bad thing. The language in the bill, as I interpret it, is that it needs to be, or that we're to detect improper patterns of repeat vendors, not just that they are repeat. So I hope that clarifies that for you. Thank you.
Members, do we have any other questions? All right, I have a few questions. Oh, Representative Roth, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know, maybe I should let me go last, haha, but I wanted to understand your kind of closing comment. To me, it sounded like that was really some good details that would really kind of wrap a pretty bow around this whole report. It's a good report and it's very detailed, and I realize a lot of this is very new and we're really, you know, really first getting our hands on this, and so there's a lot of detail still left to be done. But you did mention that you were receiving $1 million to provide certain deliverables and that you do have a plan, and I'm just wondering maybe we could get an outline of that, a little more detail of what that. So these are the things we're planning on being able to do, and da-da-da. Is that okay?
You're recognized.
Absolutely. I think not only do we have an operational work plan that was submitted, it includes a monthly spend plan, and it has articulated in there specific deliverables and planned outcomes. But one of the things that it requires me to do is to report quarterly on the expenditure of that money. The requirement for that $1 million is that we spend all of that by June 30th of 2020. So we have a lot of work to do to execute those deliverables. That money just became available yesterday. So I'm really super excited to execute on what we already have planned. We've spent the entire summer planning exactly how we would implement this project. And some of the projects that I did briefly mentioned was the cybersecurity specific training for the auditors, the investigators, and the inspectors general. One of the things that I didn't mention in much detail is that we hope to contract with a educational institution for future training. So the opportunity for us to carve out a little bit of that money and work with one of our, maybe it's, you know, somebody that already has a good cybersecurity center, or somebody that's already developing a cybersecurity institute, or something that is developing a workforce development plan for cybersecurity, if we can partner with them This is still, this piece of it is very much in and under development, what it's going to look like. We just are now entering into conversations with some of those educational institutions to see what our options are. We did have preliminary conversations, though, in preparation, knowing that we were going to be getting this infusion of investment in our program. So I think that we will be able to provide you a quarterly update that's in writing, subject to the confidentiality provisions. You as members, I believe, have that ability to see that information. So I'm super excited about what's going to happen between now and June of 2022.
You follow up?
Yes, sir.
So recognize for follow up.
Thank you, Chair. So you're saying the additional information we get will be that first quarterly report, and then from there we'll see kind of what some of the detail.
You recognize.
Thank you. Yes, but there is an existing operational work plan and a monthly spend plan that's available now that I could distribute through in consultation with your staff.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you, Chair.
I do have a few questions, and if members have other questions, we'll entertain those afterwards. As you were going through your slides, I know early on you talked about your overview of agency responses. I noticed in the slide that talked about responding agencies, the Department of State was not listed. And in a subsequent slide, I know you listed them as, I think they were number two or three for number of contracts issued. Could you talk about why they did not respond? I don't see the slide number on there.
Okay. Was that it?
It was a little...
Overview
of agency responses.
Okay. And you're talking about the...
on that slide that you just showed, it had 2,800 contracts, I think.
Oh, okay. So one there is under House Bill 1079 that talks about the number of contracts. And you're asking about the responses to the executive order, I think.
Correct, yeah. So it would be earlier than that. Yeah. There was a slide where you show 28 or so agencies that responded to your request. And I didn't see Department of State listed there.
Okay. I'm scanning just to be sure. So I can, let me double check that. We had two agencies that did not submit their responses by the time we did the draft. We did have to go back and re-request information, and I'm wondering if Department of State was in fact left off. Let me double check to be sure. Department of State does have numerous, recall them not being responsive. I recall two other agencies being responsive. Do you have any clarification? Okay.
If you go back four more slides, there's another slide where you show several agencies, and they're not there, right there.
Okay. Yeah. There were two agencies that did not respond. Department of State was not, I don't recall Department of State being one. One was Public Service Commission. But I don't recall Department of State being a non-responsive agency, but I will double check that and make sure that we fill in that detail.
Okay. And the reason I cued in on Department of State, I know that they have a multitude of functions, right? They've got, historical preservation and all kinds of things there, but also elections, right? It's a big part of what they do, and we get a lot of questions about elections integrity and sometimes contracts around how those processes work.
Yes. So when I recall going through for the Department of State, I remember that they did have a lot of grants surrounding the cultural and arts and some of those. So I do not remember them being non-responsive. We had an interim inspector general during this time that is, she also serves as the DEP inspector general. And I don't recall them being specifically non-responsive. And maybe it's just an error that they're off of this list. But I will definitely check that.
Since you mentioned PSC, mm-hmm. And I didn't really think about that one because they're a part of the legislative mm-hmm. arm. They're an extension of the legislature. Is that why they didn't respond? Is because
yes.
they're a part
yeah.
of this yeah. body?
Yeah.
Okay.
There was some discussion over whether they were required to.
Okay. In your opinion, is that something you think that we should ask for them to do anyway, just for...
So for the purpose and intent of this particular exercise, I think we were really trying to get at the grants and whether or not those grants were exceeding the compensation limits. So if I recall correctly, the PSC would have lots of contracts, but not grants.
Right.
So I will double check and offer you a comment through your staff director, if that's okay.
Wonderful. Great. In another slide, you talked about corrective actions. So when I chaired JLAC, the Joint Legislative Committee, we were able to follow up on some of the corrective actions and withhold funds and things like that. Can you talk about your powers to, as Inspector General, to be able to enforce corrective action or seek the resolution of those recommendations?
Sure. Absolutely. So the Florida Single Audit Act process is oftentimes required by both federal and state government. So many of the agencies have the Single Audit Act compliance function housed inside of the Office of Inspector General. Some agencies have this compliance function housed in finance and accounting of the state agency. Others have the Single Audit Act compliance housed with the program staff. There's no specific statutory mandate of where it's placed in an agency, but each of the folks that receive these reports, and they're generally posted on the Auditor General's website and submitted to each agency that is granting funds to these recipients, they will submit those on a cycle. When those reports come in, a person will evaluate, or people will evaluate, the content of the report and determine if corrective action is required. To some extent, the agency will have some limited authority to require corrective action. Just to offer an example, when we have a minor finding that's not a material breach of some sort, it's somewhat more on the financial back office operation versus the delivery of programs, there may be a opportunity for the agency to implement certain corrective action. If the agency requires that recipient to implement certain corrective action, the agency could withhold funds from the contract for failure to comply, if that is a specific term that's pretty clear in the contract agreement with the entity. I would submit, though, if it's a minor finding and it were to be something, let's say, with an elder care program, I would not want my grandmother to not receive services based upon a minor finding from a back office operation. So I think that there's oftentimes a balancing act between complying with an audit finding that may be insignificant to the delivery of services, but it may be significant in terms of their fiduciary or financial health, either fiduciary responsibilities or financial health. This may be an opportunity for this group to receive a copy of a report that we did. It's been about 3 years ago. The IG community coalesced and looked at the state of the state, so to speak, of the Florida Single Audit Act compliance. And we did have several recommendations. I would love to be able to provide that report to you and your colleagues if that's something that you're interested in, that may be able to address some of your concerns.
So my follow-up to that was your powers to enforce the corrective action. So you say, here's things that need to be changed. The agency says, yeah, okay, whatever. And they don't do it.
Yes.
What action are you then able to take?
Sure.
You're able to?
I think that it is limited, and it depends. And I know that that's not a really good answer, but if you look maybe at the Coalition Against Domestic Violence, that was a much more significant material finding. And so, you know, there were investigative powers. There were opportunities to enter into lawsuits where they were able to restore certain money back to the state. So depending upon the degree and significance of the issues, I think, drives the decisions at the agencies of what steps to take.
Okay. In a subsequent slide, you talked about patterns of vendor preferences, and you talked about improperly going to vendors. Can you talk about how that's measured, or will we need to wait until the report comes out to have insight into that?
I believe that you touched on a very issue that we talked about significantly internally, about how are we going to evaluate what was improper patterns or improperly going to the same vendors. So what we did, as for starters, was to identify certain high-risk categories that would trigger additional review. If I recall correctly, on those factors, one was if the contract was greater than $1 million. Another was if there was a prior audit finding or an investigative finding by an IG or the Auditor General, then that would escalate the level of risk. But there were several other factors that we entertained that might give us a chance to do some additional review that were risk-based factors. So when it comes to identifying something that might be an improper pattern of vendor preference, let's just take the Connect project as an example. If you look at the Connect project, there were 13 vendors that were involved in that. It covered 3 administrations. It went back 10 years. There was something like 11 agency heads that were involved in our review of that particular contract. So what is meant by improper for it to go to another or similar vendor or the same vendor on another project? I think that House Bill 1079 also augmented the opportunities for the agencies to put certain vendors that are not performing in a more suspended vendor list that was taking some enhancements of what was already there, but building upon that and creating additional rigor surrounding those vendors that might have not performed to the state's satisfaction, so that there is an opportunity to take greater or make it easier to put someone on a suspended vendor list or a suspicious vendor list or some categorization that would warrant them not to get a contract in the future. All of that, I think, is very deserving of due process, and the lawyers typically would get involved. So it will be difficult for us to emphatically define improperly going to or having a pattern of a vendor preference. Both of those are very subjective terms, leaving us to come up with some criteria. And I'm looking forward to being able to identifying those risk factors. And maybe there's an opportunity for us to perfect our work in year 2 after we publish our first results and see if we can entertain some of the feedback that you might have.
So you'd be potentially looking for some legislative guidance on that, because you don't
potentially
think
potentially
necessarily clear enough. Do you have a question on that vein? Representative Roth, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and I really appreciate the Chair's focus in on some of these things. You're Ms. McGill, right?
Yes, sir.
I want you to know, ma'am, I'm impressed. I'm very impressed with some of the answers you have given. One of the things I worry about, and I think a lot of us do, representing municipalities, representing corporate interests, you know, representing the vendors. One of the things I think is very important, and you did mention it, you know, that we do try to shine a light and try to figure out what's going on and looking for incongruities and things that potentially could be a problem without throwing the vendor under the bus. You know, I think it does require, you know, good management, management skills, because it's on a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. I am a little bit discouraged as a representative that I think we try to sometimes, as legislators, micromanage you guys and try to come up with a 25-point list of this is how you do it. No, that's what management is supposed to do, is see a trend in somebody looking like they may be misbehaving. We have an old phrase for that. It's called, where there's smoke, maybe there's fire. So I think we're going down the right track, but I think we do need to be careful that we, as a state, as the Inspector General and state agencies, you know, try to go move forward on being good government and working well, not only with the people. And I use as a joke the idea, me growing up and trying to get a change in my driver's license or something, and hating to go to the DMV because they always have such bad attitudes. The DMV always had bad attitudes. So we need government to be friendly. We need government to help us do our job better. And if a vendor's having some incongruities, that we're going to help the vendor get into compliance.
Representative Roth, do we have a question in there?
No, I just want to say I hope we are going in that direction. Is that generally how you perceive it?
All right. Thank you. If you have anything you'd like to respond to in there, feel free.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your comments, I'm very passionate about the role of the inspectors general trying to detect bad actors. You know, we all do a little bit more with less, and our tools. I think that like this $1 million is really going to help us with the cybersecurity front. So I appreciate you investing in what we do, and hope that our results continue to give you confidence and enhance trust in government. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McGill. I do still have some other questions on the powers of the Inspector General's office. Is it limited only to state level and statutory created agencies, or does it include local governments, other municipal entities?
So this is one of my favorite subjects, and thank you for the question. I'll try to be brief. The Florida Inspector General Act is modeled after the federal government, as I mentioned in my opening remarks. And that really, I think, has to do with the fact that the then Governor Childs had been a senator up on the Hill in Washington, D.C. So he brought, along with many of the legislative members at that time, to Florida, the Florida Inspector General Act. Our Florida Inspector General Act is at the state agency level, but Florida is unique. Florida does have more inspectors general than I think any other state in the nation. We are cutting edge. I think that we set the bar for our peers and colleagues around the country. We do have inspectors general at both the clerks of court and in certain counties. We do not have an inspector general in every county or in every school district or in every university or in every city or county, but we are moving towards bolstering the inspector general model throughout Florida that I think is in a record number compared to our other states around the country.
So again, this kind of comes full circle to the question I asked earlier about kind of Department of State and some of their activities. So you do have the jurisdiction over local governments to have inspector generals embedded in those processes. Do you have any at supervisor of elections? Again, we've gotten a lot of questions about election integrity and things like that. Do you have any currently, and is there future plans for that?
I'm aware of inspectors general being in Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, and then in clerks of court in several other areas of the state of Florida. I am not aware of any inspector general in the supervisor of elections.
Okay. And that's part of the reason why I asked that question is some of the contract piece that we talked about. So I know that with the election, with the machines, those tend to be vetted at the state level, but the contracts tend to be enacted at the local level, right? The locals end up making those contracts. If you could provide some follow-up on that, maybe after the committee, I'd love to have some conversations with you about
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. We do have an inspector general at the,
go ahead.
We do have an inspector general at the Department of State. It's a relatively small office that has jurisdiction over the state agency and any grants or contracts it has. I think that certainly there's room for discussion on the will of this legislative body on where they would want to go on oversight with elections.
Okay. When it comes to the work that's decided on, is it all done through executive orders? Is it directed at your level? Is it decided at the embedded inspector generals at the departments? Could you talk about how the work is decided and mapped out? And
absolutely. That's an excellent question. So again, it depends. Each of the state agency inspectors general have their own independent authority to establish their work plans. They develop their work plans annually. On the audit side, they have those work plans signed off by the agency, by the agency head, but they can deviate from those audit plans as necessary. They also can be very reactive to complaints that come in the door. So if there are complaints in a state agency or about a state agency or operations funded by a state agency, then they can go to that inspector general and they can open up an investigation of their own authority and latitude. So we do have also the whistleblower hotline. Many of the complaints that we get come through the whistleblower hotline as well. Those are evaluated on whether they meet the threshold under the Chapter 218, 112.3187 through 112.3195 on the Whistleblower Act. If they meet the criteria in the Whistleblower Act, then a whistleblower investigation ensues. Those are all at the decisions of the agencies. The agency inspector general is independent according to professional standards. In 2015, the governor's agencies changed their reporting structure to afford greater independence so that they now report to the chief inspector general instead of being hired and fired by the agency head. So that does afford them a little bit more independence to make decisions without fear of retaliation or repercussion.
All right. Representative Henson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to appreciate your line of questioning. It triggered some more ideas in my mind. I remember when you were talking about enforcement and when the chair was asking you about enforcement and your ability to enforce, I believe this body appropriated $2 million for a fraud detection officer and some other fraud detection activities. How is that going? Can you summarize where you are with that?
You're recognized.
Thank you for the question, and I must say I am absolutely stumped. I do not know about the appropriation that you're referencing, but I will do my homework and get back to you. I apologize.
Members, do we have any other questions? All right, seeing no further questions, thank you for your presentation today.
Thank you.
Chief Inspector, you did a great job, very thorough, and I know that there'll be some follow-up, but I just want to say thank you very much for coming in today. It's been one of the most thorough presentations that we've had.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, members, appreciate you taking the time to be here today and to join in the questions. We are coming towards a close. We have no further business before the committee, so that has completed our committee agenda. Once we adjourn, please remember to exit promptly so the sergeant staff can prepare the compare the room. Seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Federhoff moves that we rise. Without objection, meeting is adjourned.